From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the 2 years the writer David Quammen spent exploring Yellowstone for National Geographic, he learned that there are a lot of disagreements about the land and the animals. Still, what most everyone seems to agree with is that the ecosystem is much bigger than the park. Quammen is writing about the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, which doesn't conform to a drawn boundary. It's 22.6 million acres, the largest patch of contiguous public lands in the lower 48. But, Quammen asks in the article, is it big enough? And here's another one of the questions, really at the heart of his piece. Can Americans preserve this, as he puts it, gloriously inhospitable place, a place full of predators and prey? Can we preserve it in the midst of modern America? Quammen will join us today. We'll talk about if he's found an answer to that question after the news.
Spring has sprung, and KUER's community calendar has the best ways to celebrate the season. Plan your next adventure or outing at KUER.org under the Events tab. And if you own or manage an organization, submit your next donor gathering, fundraising event, or community meeting. Plan your weekend or submit your event by visiting the KUER community calendar under the Events tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's one of the images David Quammen has come up with to describe the great Yellowstone ecosystem. It's a great amoeba, a living organism he describes as an intricate, interactive compoundment of living creatures and relationships and physical factors. And here's an important part. Surrounding this great amoeba, he says, is what he calls a modest transition zone, where instead of elk, you find cows. Instead of grizzlies, there are grain silos. Right at the boundary of the park, you'll find highways and parking lots and Starbucks. But an ecosystem doesn't conform to a boundary. And in his three-part article that he's written for the latest edition of National Geographic, Quammen explores whether true wildness can be preserved in the midst of modern America. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about what he's learned in the 2 years he's been traveling the great Yellowstone ecosystem. David Quammen is, of course, a writer, a journalist, a contributing writer to National Geographic. His books include Spillover, about animal infections passing to humans. He joined us a few years ago to talk about that. He's the sole author of this May issue series called Yellowstone, The Battle for the American West. And David Quammen is joining us today from a studio in Bozeman, Montana. And David Quammen, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug. Very good to be back with you.
I just saw a quote this morning of you saying all you needed was about 5 seconds to agree to the pitch from the editor of the National Geographic to do this.
That's right, yes. Chris Johns was the editor of the magazine at the time this project was conceived. And 2016 is the centennial of the National Park Service. Chris had the idea that it would be good for the magazine to have a series of articles on national parks and the national park idea throughout the year, but that there would be one special issue devoted to the ecosystem is great, but the actual name of it is the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem.
Right, right.
And that includes Yellowstone National Park, Grand Teton, and a number of other categories of land, national forest land, wildlife refuges, some private land. And Chris asked me to write the whole text. There's been a team of photographers in the ecosystem for much of 2 years. And Chris said to me, I'm on a contract with National Geographic. And he said, well, David, we want a unity of voice for this thing. So why don't you write the whole thing?
Yeah.
As you said, you know, I thought about that for about 5 seconds, and then I said, yes, absolutely, count me in. I'd love it.
But
a lot of opportunity and a lot of pressure.
Sure. But what did you figure it was about? I mean, you jumped at it, but it's a big space, and there's a lot of issues. So what did you figure you were going to write about exactly? Did you just think you'd just jump in and find out?
It is a huge subject, right. And it's a matter of history and geology, as well as the landscape as it exists now, management issues, ecological dynamics, all of those things. I asked Chris, well, how do you want me to approach this? And he said, essentially, well, David, you tell us.
Yeah.
So I started talking to people, and I've lived in the Yellowstone ecosystem for about 30 years, and I was familiar with most of the issues and many of the places and corners of Yellowstone and the major species. But I started talking to people more broadly than I ever had before, and getting into the backcountry by a number of different modes of conveyance. And eventually I decided that there were a couple of ways to frame this whole thing. One, it was to focus on how the Yellowstone has evolved since its establishment in 1872. And it has become a bigger idea, and a better idea than the original idea. And the other thing I did was to put the grizzly bear at the center of this story and deal with the needs of the grizzly bear and how those needs ramify into all the other issues.
The first line in your piece is this: it's more than just a park. And this is an important distinction. You mentioned the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. And then there's the park. And I think in some ways maybe we think about them one and the same, but they're quite distinct. One has a boundary. One doesn't. And one fits, you know, they all fit, one fits into private land and there's public land and it's a mix of all of these things. Would you talk a little bit about the park first, though? What does that place represent, do you think, in terms of the country?
Well, the first big difference between the park and the ecosystem is that the park is big and the ecosystem is huge.
Right.
The park was founded in 1872, originally for scenic spectacle, not as a wildlife refuge. Explorers had visited it and they saw this was a place that sat on a high plateau up at 8,000, 9,000 feet. They didn't know that was because of a volcanic hotspot underneath, but that is the truth. And they saw great canyons and waterfalls and geysers and strange multicolored hot springs. And they thought this would be a great place to set aside as some sort of a public park, because then the Northern Pacific Railroad could sell tickets to tourists to come out here and sell hotel rooms to people to visit it. So it was scenic spectacle at the beginning. And then gradually the idea evolved toward being a great refuge for wildlife and ecological processes as well. Yellowstone Park proper is about just a little more than 2 million acres. It has mainly rectilinear boundaries. Mm-hmm. It sits up on this plateau, gets more than 4 million visitors a year as of last year. And it supports these species, grizzly bears and elk and bison, but it can't support them completely because those animals spill out of the boundaries of Yellowstone Park. They spill out into the surrounding lands. They spill out into the ecosystem that's not national park. And so gradually it was realized that this thing had to be thought of and protected in a broader way.
Horace Albright, one of the superintendents of Yellowstone, this was in the 20th century, in the 1920s. You quote him, and he says something interesting. He says that, the intention of Yellowstone, one of the duties, in fact, he says, of the National Park Service is to, here's the quote, present wildlife as a spectacle. And this can only be accomplished where game is abundant and where it is tame. Which sounds so strange today, but maybe that tells us something about the way they were thinking of wildlife.
Well, it does. It does. And Horace Albright is a great hero of the national parks movement in the U.S. He was the young assistant to Stephen Mather, the first director of the National Park Service. Yeah. Albright himself was superintendent of Yellowstone from 1919 to 1929. Then he became director of the Park Service. And he had this idea, as you've quoted, wildlife must be spectacle and therefore it must be abundant and tame. He also thought, as did others at that time, that there were good animals and bad animals. The good animals were the ungulates, were the herbivores, the big, gentle creatures that people loved to see: elk, deer, pronghorn, moose, bison. Those were the good animals. And the bad animals were the animals that preyed on those. Mountain lion, wolves. Wolves were persecuted systematically by the rangers of Yellowstone on the order of Albright.
Yeah.
So the idea was to eliminate the bad animals so that there would be more of the good animals for people to look at. And this went on for decades until finally more enlightened and more ecological ideas were brought in. And then the bear, the grizzly bear, was in a special category because it was a carnivore. It was sometimes a predator. It was really an omnivore.
Yeah.
It eats hundreds of different kinds of food, and it was treated as spectacle by giving it handouts. The notion of feeding bears from your car windows and letting bears feed at the dumps of the hotels was in play until the 1960s.
Yeah. When they shut them down. And we'll come back to that, because that's a really interesting, I think, an mm-hmm. important part of this story, because it leaves the grizzlies, which we'll get to later, dazed and confused, as you put it in the article. Yeah. But I want to talk about this before we get to that, this paradox, because this is a key theme of your story. And you tell the story about Lance Crosby, a 63-year-old man who worked as a seasonal nurse in the park. He's killed by a grizzly sow and her cubs. And this sort of gets us at, I think, a critical point that the greater Yellowstone, the park in particular, it's a wild place, and human limits, you know, are not going to be able to restrain wildness. And this is the paradox. And I wondered if you would talk a little bit about that, because this is an important point that you talk about in the
piece. Right, yes. And I call it the paradox of the cultivated wild, the notion that we can say, okay, we're going to protect this place because it is wild. We're going to draw a box around it. We're going to call it Yellowstone National Park. It's going to be wild, but it's going to be wild under our terms. We're going to let people in to look at the wildlife. We're even going to let them walk around. We're even going to let them go backpacking in this place. And yet it's going to be filled with these dangerous animals such as grizzly bears, wolves, mountain lions. It is paradoxical. We have to remember that animals don't obey human rules, either in terms of what to eat or where to go. So it's difficult, and it has created a tension, but it's a hugely important, valuable enterprise to try and do that, to manage this place for an approximation, a sampling of wildness. And occasionally that means somebody makes a mistake, a human makes a mistake, mm-hmm. and or a bear makes a mistake, and a person like Lance Crosby gets killed and eaten. And it's a double tragedy, because then the bear, in some cases, has to die too.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about this, but you compare how Africa in particular deal with wildness. You see, in Africa, you go there and you see wildness from a vehicle. But in America, and this seems like this is the great American gift. I mean, people who love to go backpacking in bear country, in the Grand Tetons or in Yellowstone, that's a gift. We love that. But in Africa, you stay in your car. We have to get out and walk around it. In America, as you say, we do things differently.
Yes. And I mean, of course, Africa has many different national parks in the different countries, and all of those are managed a little bit differently.
Of course. Yeah, yeah.
Every place is different. But generally, it is the rule, yes, that if you go to the Serengeti National Park in Tanzania, you go to Masai Mara in Kenya, and you're looking at the there are lions, there are leopards, there are wildebeest, giraffes, etc. You do not get out of your vehicle and walk around. You certainly do not go backpacking.
Right.
You watch these animals from the protection of a safari van or a Land Rover. But in America, we've decided, and traditionally always have, done things differently. Mm-hmm. We let people walk around out there. That doesn't mean that the animals are any less dangerous. They're not. But it means that we have given ourselves this extra privilege, and with that privilege comes extra responsibility. We need to be sensible, be informed, protect ourselves, and by protecting ourselves, we protect the animals too.
Mm. Did you get a sense that impulse, that American impulse to want to get around and get out there and walk around, is that a bad thing? I mean, is that a sense of entitlement?
Oh, I think it's a great thing.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing that people want to not just to go to Yellowstone, but to get out and walk around. I mean, I wish more of the people – well, I do and do not wish more of the people
right.
who visited Yellowstone
right.
got out and walked around.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't want 4 million people in the backcountry. And yet it is important to get out of your car and walk a bit, and yet to realize that – you know, if you walk just 100 yards or 200 yards away from a from a turnout on one of the roads of Yellowstone, you are in a wild place with grizzly bears and other dangerous animals. Mm-hmm. And you should know how to behave. You should have bear spray with you on your belt if you walk even 100 yards off the road. Things can happen. It's really wild in the Yellowstone backcountry. And the backcountry begins not very far from the front country.
Here's the question that you pose early in the piece. You say, can we hope to preserve a remnant of this, as you put it, primordial landscape, essentially in the midst of modern America? Explain that question, if you would, because this is you're sort of getting at whether we're going to be able to reconcile wildness with human needs. Is that what you're getting at there?
Yes, yes. Again, what I call the paradox of the cultivated wild. Yeah. The issue here is we want something more from Yellowstone Park and the greater Yellowstone ecosystem than we have in a very fine zoo, for instance, like the Cincinnati Zoo, which mm-hmm. has great concern for conservation. It's a very, very well-run zoo. We want Yellowstone to be more than a zoo, and that means we want not just for the animals to be there, but for their behavior, their interactions, their ecological relationships to be there. And that means we need to supply them with enough land, enough sheer landscape to support viable breeding populations of those animals and to support their relationships and their processes, like the process of migration. Elk, great herds of elk moving in and out of Yellowstone National Park seasonally, up to the highlands in the summer for the fresh green grass, down to the lowlands outside the park for the winter where they can survive the cold and snow. What we want from Yellowstone and from our other national parks is more than a zoo, more than an aquarium, more than a cage. We want a sampling of a wild ecosystem. And that's tricky.
Yeah.
And that's expensive. But it's also a magnificent aspiration.
So if we answer yes to that question, whether we can reconcile those conflicts, you say the answer is going to be found in Yellowstone, which means what? That this is really going to be, could be anyway, the model for us to deal with these conflicts all around the West and all around the country?
It is the model, and it is our best hope for preserving the full complement of animals and processes of a western northern Rocky Mountain ecosystem, because Yellowstone is large. That's one of the crucial things. Yellowstone Park is one of our largest national parks. It's the largest in the lower 48, and the greater Yellowstone ecosystem is the largest contiguous mass of wild landscape, both public and private, within the confines of the lower 48. And that largeness is part of what makes preservation of a grizzly bear population, a wolf population, an elk population with migration, a mountain lion population, all of these things makes them possible, the fact that it's big enough to support these populations and these processes.
David Quammen is with us. He wrote the May issue of National Geographic. It's called Yellowstone, The Battle for the American West. We have a link to it on our website. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer David Quammen is joining us to talk about Yellowstone. He wrote the entire May issue of National Geographic, and in it he explores Yellowstone as the country's first national park, but also as one of the world's most important ecosystems, the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. And here are the stakes from Quammen's point of view. If there's hope in preserving wild landscapes and reconciling it to the needs of humans, that hope lies in Yellowstone. The entire edition is called Yellowstone, The Battle for the American West. David Quammen is joining us from Bozeman, Montana today. Something like 9 modes of travel over the last 2 years. You went going through Yellowstone. I get that. Let me talk about one in particular. You went above Yellowstone with the pilot Roger Stradley. Give us a sense just of that. I mean, I know there may be people out there who have done that, who've sort of traveled the scope of that space, but you saw some pretty magnificent things. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, this was an extraordinary day, an extraordinary privilege for me. Roger Stradley is a bush pilot based on an airport outside of Bozeman. When I flew with him, he was 76 and had been flying in the mountains for 62 years. He had something like 70,000 hours of flying time. He flies a lot for the biologists who do radio tracking of wildlife populations in Yellowstone Park. That means the bears, wolves, the elk to some extent. So Roger flies a 1956 yellow Piper Super Cub, which is an old-fashioned plane that flies very well at low elevations and low speeds. That's the advantage of a Piper Super Cub.
Right.
So I piled into this thing behind Roger, climbing into a cockpit, a tight little cockpit right behind him, sort of front to back, you know. And we took off and we flew over Yellowstone in a great loop for about 4 or 5 hours at low elevation. And it was just, as I say in the piece, it was just it was wonderfully sort of transporting. It was like you were attached to a great kite pulled through the air.
Wow.
At low elevation and low speed. So we flew over the Lamar Valley, which is filled with wolves, in the northeastern corner of Yellowstone. We flew down along the Absaroka Mountains along the east border of Yellowstone. We flew down through and beyond the southeast corner of Yellowstone into a legendary corner of landscape known as the Thoroughfare Area. This is at the headwaters of the Yellowstone River in a wilderness area just outside Yellowstone National Park. Then we looped around and flew back over the geysers and finally back up across the Gallatin Mountains. And we were looking down, meanwhile, at wolves, at grizzly bears, at both of those animals on bison carcasses. This was early in the summer, so there were bison carcasses left from winter kill. And we could see everything just sort of gliding along. And Roger gave me this running commentary of what we were seeing. Down there, there's a lot of morel mushrooms left from the fires. Great place if you want to collect mushrooms, except don't go in there because the grizzly bears are there first. And it's a little bit dicey to compete with them for the mushrooms. All this commentary. It was a great privilege to fly with Roger.
Well, your lasting impression of that flight, and it's a beautiful bit of writing, watching this massive grizzly bear eating flowers, which is such an image and conveys really the complexity of the story, the complexity of their diet. Really understanding the story is sort of bound up with the things that these big creatures eat.
That's right. Yeah, as we came up the Gallatin, we went over one mountain, and near the top of this mountain, in sort of this meadowy area, was one great big grizzly bear, probably 700 or 800 pounds. And we flew over the top, and Roger said, "What's he eating? I can't tell what he's eating. He's in those yellow flowers. That looks like balsam root, but balsam root does not provide a nutritious root that grizzlies eat. They do eat tubers, but that's not one of the species." We flew around again, and Roger said, "I think he's eating the flowers themselves." I checked that with a bear biologist later, and he told me, yes, among the 266 items of food grizzly bears in Yellowstone are known to eat, one of them is balsam root flowers. So this was a big grizzly alone on the top of a mountain in the Gallatin Range eating flowers.
It seems like you, I don't know, is it fair to say you have a sort of a deep personal affection for the grizzly bear? I mean, this is kind of, as you say, that one of the focuses, the focus, I think, of your article.
Yes, I think anybody who spent time in the backcountry in the Yellowstone area has probably a deep affection as well as a deep respect for the grizzly bear, this magnificent omnivore, the most formidable land mammal on the North American continent, and an animal that has survived and is now doing much better in this ecosystem that's surrounded by modern America. That's what's so amazing. One of the things that's so amazing about Yellowstone is that here's a population of grizzly bears, 700 to 1,000 grizzly bears now, a population much recovered, in the Yellowstone ecosystem, surrounded by the New West, surrounded by modern America. How can that be? Well, because we've been lucky and we've done some things right. How can that be preserved? Well, we need to continue to do things right. And I try and describe some of the dynamics of that.
Yeah. The garbage dumps, as you mentioned, were closed in 1967. And this left the bears, as you say, dazed and confused and reckless. And they got into a lot of trouble. And this really seemed to have devastated grizzly populations. And in fact, you say, and I hadn't realized this, you say the decline of that era, if that had continued on that pace, the Yellowstone grizzly could have died out completely?
Yes, yes, it easily could have. The population fell to about 140 bears. Grizzly bears are difficult to count, but that's the best estimate. Yeah. Then in 1975, grizzlies were listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, meaning, among other things, no more legal hunting of grizzly bears, and other constraints on how grizzly bears would be managed, would be dealt with. And then the bear biologists and the managers of Yellowstone and Grand Teton Parks and the other officials involved charged with grizzly bear recovery, including the Grizzly Bear Recovery Coordinator, worked to bring back the grizzly bear population. And it's been a success story. The population has bounced back. Bear mortality was lowered. Bear reproduction came back up. We now have somewhere between 700 and 1,000 grizzly bears in the ecosystem, 717, according to the latest official count slash estimate, within the area that the biologists monitor, which doesn't include the entire ecosystem. So they guess that maybe 1,000 bears throughout the ecosystem. Great success story. And now, of course, the discussion, and it's a complicated discussion, is as to whether the grizzly should be delisted, taken off the endangered species list. Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed that, and it's now open for public comment.
You don't really wade into or at least express an opinion on where you are on that idea of whether they should be delisted or not. But you do also say that when it comes to the grizzly, you don't share the pessimism of some grizzly advocates like Doug Peacock, who we had on the program several years ago. I mean, you have, there is some sense of optimism on your part that these bears can, if we get this right anyway, I guess, they can adapt. Yeah?
There is. And in terms of delisting, Doug Peacock is a dear friend of mine, a close friend. And I've talked with him about this many times. And back in 2007, when the grizzly was briefly delisted, I was against delisting. I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times opposing delisting. Since then, the population has stayed high, and my own ideas have shifted a bit, and partly because I am more optimistic and partly because I feel that we have come to a stalemate with grizzly management in the West. And in order to move forward and to get more social tolerance for the grizzly, it's not unreasonable to consider delisting. But if the bear is delisted, as I've said and others have said, the devil is in the details. It matters hugely how the delisting is arranged. If there are hunting seasons in Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming, it depends hugely on how those hunting seasons are run. But I decided not to either advocate delisting or oppose delisting in this special issue because I want people to engage with the complexities, engage with the details of that before they're knee-jerks and they have an emotional opinion, either for or against delisting. It's complicated, people. Yeah. So invest a little time, do the homework, read up on this, and then by all means, express your opinions and vote on this because it's an important question.
Well, let's talk about some of these sort of intricate webs that gives us a sense of how complicated all of this is. You talk about, write about in the piece, some of the critical species, for example, the cutthroat trout, for example, who suffered from all kinds of for all kinds of different reasons, drought and the introduction of lake trout, and you know from the Midwest, which is complicated. You write about the white bark pine nuts, you know, and of course their greatest enemy, as you point out, is the mountain pine beetle. This is an issue of global climate change. So you have declines in that sense, and then you have the army cutworm moth, which seems to
be
a
good story. And what we should say, Doug, is that the reason I'm talking about these is that these are the four major foods that the grizzly has traditionally depended on since the closure of the dumps. There are four high-calorie, extremely nutritious, supportive food items. The three that you've mentioned, cutthroat trout spawning out of Yellowstone Lake, whitebark pine nuts in the high country, army cutworm moths, which are these moths that fly in from the Great Plains. The army cutworm moth is an agricultural pest in Kansas and Nebraska. The larvae feed on the roots of crops, but when they turn into moths, adults, and the summer gets hot, they migrate to the Yellowstone High Country. They fly hundreds of miles to spend their time in the rocks, the scree piles, scree slopes, in the Absaroka Mountains above 9,000 feet. And the grizzlies go up there to eat them. They eat gazillions of these moths. And it's amazing, and most people don't know about it. And then the final major item on the grizzly diet is meat, ungulate meat. And that means elk calves, weakened elk, who grizzlies can kill after the rut in the fall, and bison, particularly bison that die during the winter. Winter kill bison with carcasses left available when grizzlies come out of hibernation in the spring. So those are the four traditionally major foods of the Yellowstone grizzly. Ungulate meat, whitebark pine seeds, army cutworm moths, and cutthroat trout. And some of those four are already threatened by human-caused changes, and some of them are essentially hostage to potential human-caused changes. And so when we think about what the grizzly is going to do in the future, we have to think about what it's going to eat. Yeah. And if some of those food sources collapse or decline, the grizzlies are going to have to adapt to other foods, some of those 262 other items that they eat. The biologists say grizzlies are extraordinarily adaptable, enterprising, and they can adapt. And pessimists like my good friend Peacock say, no, we should not delist because this is a moment of insecurity for grizzly food sources. It's tricky, it's complicated, and you have to pay attention to the details.
I wanted to ask you more about the meat part of that equation, the ungulates in particular, elk, because elk you write about. I had no idea that you write about in the early days of Yellowstone, there's a character, General Philip Sheridan. He's kind of a brutal guy, but seeing Yellowstone, you say, brings out a kind of appealing part of his character. And he, what's interesting about this part of the story I wanted you to talk about is he says, you know, yes, it's big, but let's make it bigger because it's not actually enough for the way elk in particular move. Would you talk about
yes.
that part?
Yeah, and this is I love this this character because he's so counterintuitive. This notorious, as you say, brutal Indian fighter, Indian killer, General Phil Sheridan, he comes to Yellowstone in the 1880s and he sees this newly established national park and he says, well, you made it too small. And what he meant by that is something that's still very important, and that is that you left out the winter range for the elk. You left out the places where the animals migrate in winter, the lowlands adjacent to the park. And so he backed a proposal. He initiated a proposal that was presented in Congress to expand Yellowstone almost to double the size of the park in the 1890s, would have added 40 miles along the eastern boundary and 10 miles along the south boundary and would have brought in a lot of that winter range. But the proposal failed. Mm-hmm. And so those animals continued migrating out of the park onto lands that were less protected, and we're still dealing with that today. Fortunately, most of those lands are still intact, either because they're national forest land or because of big private ranches that have kept them together and remain hospitable to elk.
There's that, and there's that preserve, of course, right outside of Jackson Hole, for example.
The National Elk Refuge, right?
That refuge, yeah. Right. So, so this is a, I guess this is gives you some sense of hope. This part of the story, anyway, that there is enough land to still get this right. That it's not all overtaken by development, for example, in this part.
Yes, right. It does gives me a lot of hope. Although there are still things that we have to do right. And one of the things that has to be done right is that we have to do everything possible to encourage those big private ranches to stay intact. I mean, I'll be very, very candid with you, Doug. Some people in the conservation community, which I count myself a member of, and Bozeman here is a hotbed of conservation organizations, some people in the conservation community tend to dislike rich people from elsewhere and hunters. But rich people from elsewhere who own big ranches in the Yellowstone ecosystem and hunters who are a constituency for habitat and for thriving elk populations, they, whether we like it or not, they happen to be very important to the conservation equation in Greater Yellowstone.
David Quammen is with us. When we get back from a break, we'll talk about wolves. It's another one of those really highly disputed creatures in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. David Quammen wrote the May issue of National Geographic. It's called Yellowstone, the Battle for the American West. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with David Quammen. We're talking about the special issue that he's written for the National Geographic, the May edition of the magazine called Yellowstone, the Battle for the American West. He spent 2 years putting this piece together. Let's talk about wolves. You mentioned in your piece there's disagreement about the role of wolves on the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. What can you say? What do you think you learned about the way they are, in fact, reshaping the region? Because there's dispute about that. There's not a lot of agreement, it doesn't seem, or a consensus anyway.
Right. Well, wolves were eradicated from Yellowstone in the 1930s when they were persecuted and eradicated from much of the American West. And then for 60 years, there were no wolves, and there were consequences of the absence of wolves. Ungulate populations exploded. Mm-hmm. Elk, in particular, became grotesquely abundant in Yellowstone, and the elk ate up a lot of the aspen and willow shoots and changed some of the vegetation profile, and may have had some impact on beaver populations and songbirds and other things. And then in 1995, wolves were reintroduced to Yellowstone. Wolves from Canada were brought down and sort of soft released in the Lamar Valley, meaning that they lived in pens for a while until they were sort of adjusted to the new place and the pens were open, and they went wild on the landscape, and they have thrived since then. So now there's about 10 wolf packs in Yellowstone, and they've spread out through Wyoming and Montana and Idaho, and wolves are back. Wolves are very controversial. Mm-hmm. Some people hate wolves, but they play an important role in the Yellowstone ecosystem. They eat many of those overabundant elk. They eat deer. They prey on other creatures, but mostly their staple food is elk. The discussion now, the disagreement is as to whether wolves have essentially the reintroduction of wolves has fixed all the problems that the elimination of wolves caused.
Yeah.
And the message from a careful study of the ecology is that, no, it's not that simple. If you take something, an element like wolves, out of an ecosystem, then there are consequences and repercussions. And putting wolves back into the ecosystem does not necessarily fix all of the problems that removing wolves created. So everybody agrees that it's great to have wolves back. It's important ecologically. And the discussion is really over over the question of whether they are sort of a panacea or merely one element in terms of making Yellowstone whole again.
There's another great character you write about, Arthur Middleton, the elk hippie, I guess. And he has this idea that the role of wolves, as you just expressed, is being kind of oversimplified. He said there's this idea that to have wolves shine rainbows out of their asses is how he puts it. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that, because it seems like this is where the conflict is really happening, at least from Middleton's point of view, is it's not just the park, but it's also the lands outside of the park. And would you talk about that?
Yeah, Arthur Middleton is a great young fella, a smart biologist from the Yale Forestry School, who came out and worked on his PhD through the University of Wyoming studying wolf-elk interactions. And he has put together a wonderfully full picture of the elk migrations. Arthur is still sort of shaking his head at me that I quoted him to that effect when he said we were in the backcountry.
Now he's on the radio.
Now it's on the radio. Well, the wolf solved everything. That's just it's an unproven theory in the attempt to have wolves shine rainbows out of their asses. That discussion is a pretty technical scientific discussion among the biologists. It's about something that the ecologists call trophic cascades. Trophic cascades essentially is a fancy way of saying falling ecological dominoes. To what extent does one falling domino knock down all the other dominoes? And the discussion is, as I say, it's kind of technical. It's very interesting. The ecologists disagree about it, but it's sort of separate from the wider controversy about wolves, which is whether they should be there at all. The agricultural community is pretty anti-wolf. That's probably a polite understatement. People hate wolves in a way that nobody hates grizzly bears or mountain lions. It's hard to understand why.
Do you think you do understand? We've actually tried to do shows that explore what it is. Do you think you understand what it is?
No, I'm positive that I don't understand. Next time you do that show, call me up so I can listen.
Okay.
I'm waiting for somebody to explain.
Well, I mean,
this.
If you look at the way grizzlies kill, they're brutal when they kill. So are wolves. But why would a wolf be different from the perspective of a rancher or anyone else?
I don't know. I mean, it goes back to the Middle Ages. It goes back to myths and legends about wolves. It might go back to the fact that we have domesticated the wolf and turned him into man's best friend, the dog. Mm-hmm. And a wolf looks pretty similar to a Malamute. And so when wolves do what they're supposed to do, which is be wild animals, killing prey, some people might feel some sort of a deep sense of betrayal. I don't know. That's one hypothesis. But can I explain it? No. Yeah. My friend Barry Lopez wrote a book about this years ago, Of Wolves and Men, and tried for 300 pages to explain it and raise some interesting ideas. But it is, I think, essentially inexplicable. There is a ferocity of hatred toward wolves that goes beyond their admitted costs to people who raise livestock on wild landscape, including, in some cases, public lands. Mm.
There's a question that came from a listener in Bountiful, Jonathan. It's a pretty good question. He refers to this book you may or may not know. It's a book called Playing God in Yellowstone, which raises these questions about whether or not the greater Yellowstone ecosystem was in fact destroyed by government mismanagement. So his question is, given the government's record, can the government be trusted to manage Yellowstone or be transparent about that management? Do you have an opinion on that?
I do know that book. It was written by Alston Chase, friend of mine over in Livingston, Montana. It was written about 25 years ago, if I recall correctly. Alston has, let me put this diplomatically, has an extremely cynical attitude and a suspicious attitude toward the federal government and federal management of Yellowstone. In the last 2 years, I have spent a ton of time with wildlife managers, biologists, and other managers in Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. I do not share Alston's conspiracy theories about things, the forms of malpractice that he asserted that he was seeing in Yellowstone 25 years ago. So that book is out there, and Alston is a good fellow, but it's not a book whose vision I share.
Yeah. in the article, I loved all, and we should say that, of course, it's National Geographic, so there are some extraordinary photographs, amazing photographs. And
would you say something
about the images? Because it's kind of fun to work through your article and then stop at a beautiful image of a grizzly or a wolf.
Yeah. I would love to say something about the images. I mean, one of the great things about working for National Geographic magazine, which I've done for 17 years now, is that you get to work with some of the world's finest photographers. And a number of them were pulled together for this project. So there was a team of six or seven who spent much of a year or more in the ecosystem, and two or three others who spent part of that time. And their photographs are in this issue. They grace this issue. Some amazing photographs of wildlife and people interacting with the landscape and geological figures. My friend Nick Nichols, Michael Nick Nichols, who was a longtime staff photographer for National Geographic and with whom I've done I don't know how many articles in Africa. He led this team. A number of others, people will really enjoy. I hope people read this issue, but whether they do or not, they'll really enjoy looking through this issue at some of the amazing images of grizzlies, of bison, of migrations in action, of people on the landscape that that are contained in this package.
I want to ask you about Dave Halleck. Interesting voice in all of this because, and when you look at the wildlife numbers, you go down this litany, grizzly bear populations have rebounded, wolves are back, the bison seems secure, the beaver are coming back, there's an effort to protect antelope, bald eagles seem to be doing well. So if you look at all of those things, you would say, hey, the greater Yellowstone ecosystem is going to make it. But Dave Halleck said to you, I think we're losing this place.
Yes, and I should emphasize, Dave Halleck at that moment was chief scientist for Yellowstone National Park. I was sitting with him at lunch one day, and he said, just in casual, well, it wasn't very casual, but it was private conversation. Right. I was not taping him or didn't have my notebook out, and he said, you know, I think we're losing this place. I said, what do you mean, Dave? And I came back. That was a busy day. We were in the midst of a conference. So I came back a month or two later and I said, I want to follow up on that. Tell me what you meant when you said, I think we're losing this place. He said, well, I don't think we're losing it suddenly, but I think we're in the midst of what I call a creeping crisis. We are in danger of losing the place incrementally in a cumulative fashion over a period of time. What was he talking about? He was talking about the concatenation of problems and issues facing the Yellowstone ecosystem, bison management, whether bison are allowed to migrate out of the park, and despite the fact that they carry a disease that can potentially infect cattle, elk migration, grizzly bear conservation, private land development in the region, human population growth, and the explosion of visitors to Yellowstone, invasive species like the lake trout that have crashed the cutthroat trout population in Yellowstone Lake, climate change affecting the whitebark pine, all of these things. And then he said to me, we grow around telling everybody this is the most intact ecosystem in the lower 48, and it is. Yellowstone ecosystem is probably in better shape now than ever. But then he said, if that's so important, if that's so special, it's time for us to do a lot better when it comes to protecting it. And then he proceeded to talk about what he had in mind there. At the top of the list was integrated management, integrated decision-making across the different administrative entities of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem.
Well, because here's the question. Who's in charge of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem? As you say, everybody and nobody. We haven't figured
everybody
this out
yet. Everybody
and
nobody, yes. Yeah, five national forests, each of which has a forest supervisor, two national parks, each of which has a superintendent, two wildlife refuges, each of which has a director. Those are all federal. BLM lands, private lands throughout the ecosystem, and there's each of those parcels of land has a different boss, a different owner. All of these things, the Wind River Indian Reservation is part of it is included within the ecosystem. There is a Greater Yellowstone Coordinating Committee that is intended to do integrated management, but it doesn't have all the power that it might have, and it doesn't have all the membership that it might have. It doesn't include anything on the main committee except the federal entities. So that's what David Halleck was talking about. Arthur Middleton has talked about this too. A need, if we're going to preserve Yellowstone as an intact place, for there to be intact management.
We need a collaborative solution, you say, not continuing warfare. Are you seeing that? Are you seeing people finally coming together on the, at least the points that they can agree on?
Well, they're trying. They're trying. Is there great progress? No, I wouldn't say there's great progress, but there's a continuing effort and realization among some of the managers, maybe most of the managers, that we really need to work together. The two superintendents of the park, Dan Wank, superintendent of Yellowstone, David Vela, superintendent of Grand Teton, are public servants, I think, of the highest caliber, and they are aware of this, and they're trying to move toward this, and we're lucky to have them, and it would be good if we make progress on their watch.
Well, seeing Yellowstone change General Sheridan, it really brought out the better angels of his nature. So the question is, should people go? I mean, it seems you seem conflicted about that. Do go, but don't go. I mean, I guess.
Do go, but don't. Well, yes, people should go.
Right.
People should go, but they should not be demanding. They should realize that it's a great privilege to visit Yellowstone. It's a life-changing experience for young people and for adults in many cases, and yet there have to be constraints. You have to obey the rules. The rules may change. It may be in the future that you can't drive your private automobile through Yellowstone, but by all means, go see the place. Hike in the backcountry, if you're so inclined. Obey the rules. Carry bear spray. Don't put bears in danger by getting yourself killed and eaten. And another problem with Yellowstone is that people are moving to the Yellowstone ecosystem. People are buying pieces of private land. People are, you know, the obvious phrase is loving it to death. Not everybody who loves the Yellowstone ecosystem needs to own a ranch in the Yellowstone ecosystem, large or small. So I would say visit the place, enjoy it, but that doesn't mean you need to build a cabin in this ecosystem and own a piece of the wild. That's another paradox.
David Quammen, he wrote the special May issue of National Geographic called Yellowstone, the Battle for the American West, joined us from Bozeman, Montana. David, thanks again.
Thank you, Doug. Really good to talk with you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.